Good afternoon and welcome. My name is Bob Wise, and I'm the president of the Alliance for Excellent Education. As many of you know, All for Ed is a national policy and advocacy organization dedicated to ensuring that all students, particularly those who are traditionally underserved, graduate from high school ready for success in college, a career, and citizenship. On behalf of All for Ed and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, welcome to today's webinar, or more accurately, our book talk. This book today is called World Class, How to Build a 21st Century School System, and its author is my friend, Andreas Schleicher. Andreas is known across the U.S. and the world as the Director for Education and Skills and Special Advisor on Education Policy to the Secretary General at the OECD. The OECD is a forum in which governments work together to promote policies that will improve the economic and social well-being of people around the world. A key member of OECD's senior management team, Andreas supports the Secretary General's strategy to produce analysis and policy advice that advances economic growth and social progress. He promotes the work of the Directorate for Education and Skills on a global stage and fosters cooperation both within and outside the member nations of the OECD, and just as he's doing today with us. The work of the Directorate includes the Program for International Student Assessment, or PISA, the Teaching and Learning International Survey, TALIS, and the Program for the International Assessment of Adult Competencies, or PIAC, among others. In his new book, he writes, "Every economic age has its core asset. In the agricultural age, that asset was land. In the industrial age, it was capital. And in our times, it is the knowledge, skills, and character qualities of people. This core asset remains largely untapped and undervalued. It's time for us to change that." While improvement in education is far easier to proclaim than achieve, in his book, Andreas examines the many successes from which to learn, looking seriously and dispassionately at good practice in countries around the world, all to understand what works and in which contexts. Now, before we get into the nitty-gritty about world class, a few technical details. We encourage you to join the conversation via Twitter using the hashtag worldclass. Today's event will be archived on www.allfored.org/webinars. And lastly, grab your free, yes, you heard correct, your free digital copy of this book by going to the link below. I want to congratulate you, Andreas. You are the first person I've ever seen who does an international book tour for a book that online is free. So people can download it as we speak right now from the site just given and engage in the discussion. So thank you very, very much for preparing this. So let's just jump right into questions. And my first question is, You've been making presentations. You've been talking and educating governments, policymakers, educators. We've worked together almost 14 years now. I know you've been doing much longer. What's the impetus for the book now?
You know, I think I have an incredibly privileged position at the OECD. I've been accompanying educational leaders all around the world over the last 20 years, seeing, you know, how they design, how they implement education policies. And I thought it's time to give something back, to put something of that experience down on paper so that we can actually learn from good experience elsewhere. And actually, the moment I decided to write this book was when I saw some of the poorest children in Shanghai learning from some of the world's best teachers, really, and actually achieving results that were on par with what we achieve in very wealthy communities in our countries. And that's when I understood, you know, we can give a future to millions of children who currently don't have one. It's something that is not impossible, that is actually doable. And building on PISA that was already available, we have those kinds of data. We know what counts. We can measure high quality learning outcomes, and we can now make that accessible. And they derive lessons from this. So that's also why I devote a large part of the book, not just on, you know, what to do, but also how to get to start. Now, how have the most advanced education systems got to where they are now?
And so you have always, of course, been an advocate of using data, as I believe you're the one who coined, without data, you're just another opinion. And so is there something that's happening in the world now that was a further impetus for writing this book?
Well, we live in a dramatically changing world. If you think about the power of artificial intelligence, you know, changing how we think, how we work, and we need to figure out how to respond in education to this. And it's a lot easier to educate students for our past than for their future. You know, education is a kind of inherently conservative social enterprise, you know. And we are, as parents, we are part of the problem. We get very nervous when our children learn things that we haven't really learned when we went to school, and we get even more nervous when children don't learn things that were so terribly important for us at this time. Or teachers are much more likely to teach how they were taught than how they were taught to teach. And as you know really well, you know, for policymakers, you know, you can lose an election over education, but you rarely win one over education because it just takes so much more time to get good ideas and a good practice in classrooms. So I think there's a lot of change that is happening. You know, some people say changing education is like, you know, moving a graveyard. No, you can't just rely on the people out there to help you with this. It is really, really hard. And the biggest risk to schooling today is not just its inefficiency. No, it's that schooling is risking to lose its currency, its relevance. No. And when fast gets really fast, being slow to adapt makes you fall behind very, very quickly. Now, the kind of things that are easy to teach, easy to test, have also become easy to digitize, to outsource. Now, those things are no longer relevant. Education sort of has won the race with technology throughout human history. But there's no automaticity that that's going to continue this way. I think there's a real risk for education to lose out, for technology to get so far ahead of people that we're not catching up. Now, when we could still assume that what you learn in school is lasting for your lifetime, teaching educational content was rightly at the heart of education. Today, you know, in the world of Google, it doesn't matter what you know. Now, Google actually knows everything. What matters a lot more is what you can do with what you know. In the time of artificial intelligence, the question is how we can pair capacities that we have created in our computers with the human qualities that make us different, the cognitive, the social and emotional qualities. I think it requires a very, very different education kind of experience. The one thing that artificial intelligence really does is make us think much harder of what makes us human, and then to think about what education needs to be to deliver in this. Now, tomorrow's students need to be able to think for themselves, to work with others, to appreciate how different people think and work in different, sometimes in different cultures, to have a good sense of right and wrong, you know, being ethical in their judgment, to have a deeper understanding of other people. And whatever tasks machines may take over at work, you know, lots of people talk about the future of work, the requirements to be an active participant in our societies is actually going to continue to rise in terms of the demand it places on students. And that's where the current model of schooling really gets to its limits. Schooling was invented in the industrial age when it was actually effective and efficient to educate students in batches, giving them all the same kind of education, moving them to the same experience and so on. You know, I started my career in medical research. You know, in medicine, you know, the first thing you think about is, you know, what is wrong with you? How can I help you? What kind of prescription will be make you happy and healthy again? In education, we start by giving everybody the same medicine, putting everybody through the same kind of treatment. And then maybe by the year of graduation, we start to think about, you know, was it really successful? I think we have to change that model of education, get to a much more personal, individual education if we want to be successful today. And I think that's something where particularly children from disadvantaged backgrounds are falling through the cracks of current systems. They're not, you know, made for this kind of standardized approach. And if you come from a wealthy background, you always find open doors to life, no? Even if you don't succeed so well in school. But if you come from a disadvantaged background, you really have only one chance in life, one card to play, and that is a good schooling. You miss that boat, you're not going to get a second chance. And that's why it is so important for us to rethink that model of schooling, to design learning experiences that capitalize on the potential of all learners. And that's what I learned from PISA. There are education systems that actually are successful to move, you know, from sorting human talent to really developing human talent, to realize that ordinary students can have extraordinary talent and to actually make sure that those come to bear.
So what are some of the elements that you've observed that successful education systems are employing to reach this?
Well, you know, it starts with, you know, the value they place on education. That's the first thing that you can really see. You know, most high-performing education systems value their future more than the present. You know, Singaporean parents will spend their last time, the last resources on the future, you know, on the education of their children. In our parts of the world, we have already spent the money of our children for our own consumption today. I think so that value is very important. You can see that reflected in high performance. But more important, it's also about, you know, placing a value in education gets you only so far. The other part of the equation is the belief that every student can learn. Now, that sounds almost trivial, but it's a big part of the secret of success of high-performing systems. Now, they are not, you know, tracking and streaming and sorting students. They're actually personalizing learning experience. They have high expectations for every learner. They attract the most talented teachers into the most challenging classrooms. They match resources with needs. They find out how different students learn differently and actually without lowering performance expectations. That's one thing. The third thing is about, you know, teaching. They succeed in making teaching not just financially attractive, but intellectually attractive. They get best and brightest people becoming teachers because they offer an amazing work organization. You go to countries like Finland or Japan, as different as them. You know, there is a career for teachers. And as a teacher, you're not only sitting in the classroom teaching students, but you're also investing in the profession. You're advancing professional knowledge. You're working with your colleagues to frame good practice. You invest in your own professional development and in the development of your colleagues. So I think that combination of a high degree of professional autonomy and a collaborative culture in the kind of education workforce is very, very key to this. And that's then reflected in work organization. You see much less vertical accountability, but a lot more knowledge sharing and lateral accountability in the system. A lot more innovation. Good ideas get scaled and spread in the system, get developed at the front line. And last thing is about resources. Those systems are very careful. They don't spend actually often a lot on education, but they spend their money really carefully, making sure that the money arrives where it can really make most of a difference.
You write in your book about choice, school choice, and you make some observations about where it's successful and where it's not. Could you talk about that some?
Yeah, you know, in some education systems like the Netherlands, like Belgium or Hong Kong, actually, choice and vouchers are very successful. Actually, those systems have succeeded in reconciling flexibility and choice in the systems with quality, coherence, and equity. And in a way, you know, what I've learned is that choice in itself neither assures quality nor undermines quality necessarily. What is actually the key to success is the kind of regulatory frameworks and policies that we use to actually, you know, again, link choice with equity in the education systems. When market mechanisms are in place, you know, public policy needs to shift from overseeing individual schools to providing oversight over the system, providing the mechanisms that parents only have good choices. You can't put that all on the burden of parents to figure out what are the good, well-performing schools, actually. The system has a lot of responsibility to ensure that parents have only good choices. The system has a lot of responsibility to provide parents with good information about, you know, what are the criteria for quality, what is the right school for my child, to ensure that every child benefits from excellent education. I really think sort of the Netherlands is a great example where most schools are run by, you know, philanthropic organizations, sometimes religious organizations, but every private school considers itself part of the public system. They're not atomized. They're not isolated. They are all part of the system. There's a lot of mobility among teaching staff across the different school providers. So in one way, you know, what I've learned is that the more choice and flexibility you have, the stronger public policy really needs to be to moderate that system and to ensure that, you know, choice and equity are going together. It can be done. I mean, there are a good example. Compensatory finance is very important. Now, how do you make it attractive for schools to, you know, deal with difficult kind of situations, with maybe difficult students, disadvantaged students? Now, linking resources with needs is very important. Formula-based funding often is very important in choice-based and voucher-based systems. But I think the world has great examples for this. The world also has some very poor examples where choice has actually led to social segregation and actually sometimes to decline in quality. You look to Sweden as an example.
And throughout the book, you address the various misconceptions in education about the abilities of historically underserved children to learn and perform, particularly among the more privileged peers. Would you talk some about what you consider these misconceptions to be?
Yeah, you know, I think there are lots of misconceptions. You know, the first is, you know, the poor will always do badly in school. And that's simply not true. You know, in fact, again, the 10% most disadvantaged students in the province of Shanghai do as well as the 10% wealthiest students in large American cities. Or more immigrant students will drag down the performance on international comparisons. It's not true. There's actually no relationship between the share of immigrant students in a system and the performance of their country on PISA. Now, actually, what we see is that the country where you go to school has a much greater impact on your success than the country where you come from. Or, you know, misconception about class size. Smaller class size is always better for results. Actually, smaller classes have often driven the kind of Tayloristic work organizations where we have taken away from teachers very important non-teaching working time. By focusing on small classes, we have, you know, pushed teachers to teach many more hours and taken away the time they need for professional development, for professional collaboration, for working with individual students, for working with parents. So there are many myths in education that hold us back in current practice. And international comparisons are a great, you know, way to think outwards, to think out of the box, to look at, you know, what we can actually do to learn from best practice in this.
Is PISA in the more recent data, is that able to capture the impact of the great wave of immigration that we've seen both in Europe and somewhat in the United States?
Well, it goes up to 2015. We see what's happened. And that includes significant increases in immigration in Europe. Not all of that. That's going to be coming out in the 2018 wave. But once again, you know, I think what these data show very clearly is that it's a lot more to do with what we do to integrate those students. Now, you can see countries like Canada in North America or Sweden and in Europe, that and the Netherlands again, that have been very, very good in ensuring that those students quickly integrate into the system. They have very high expectations, high standards for them, but they often embed, you know, the cultural origin of the students in the curriculum material so the students can find themselves. And if you do not manage that transition and, you know, the first couple of years for students, you face an uphill struggle. No? But I think actually, again, the world provides plenty of really good examples, and I discuss many of them in the book. Very impressive kind of examples.
So another recurring theme in the book is that of crowdsourcing, which interested me greatly. Crowdsourcing education or grassroots education. Can you talk some about how education systems are able to maintain accountability when they also have a bottom-up approach to curriculum?
Yeah, you know, I think what most educational systems that are doing really well have created a strong sense of ownership of professional practice among its teachers. And I meet many people who say, you know, you cannot give teachers more kind of discretion and professional responsibility in the schools because they may not have the capacity to deliver on that. And I think there's always sort of a difficult kind of trade-off and balance in this. But, you know, simply perpetuating a kind of prescriptive model of teaching with vertical accountability will not produce more creative teachers. In fact, you know, those who are trained only to heat up, you know, pre-cooked hamburgers are never going to become a master chef. No? So again, how do you create the conditions that allow teachers to grow? How do you create the space in schools for them to experiment, to develop ownership over their classrooms, ownership over learning processes? This is where we see really good outcomes at scale. Now, the challenge is really to combine transparency, professional autonomy, collaborative culture, and also trust in the system. Now, when I visited Shanghai in 2013, I saw teachers sharing their lessons, their plans, their projects on a digital platform. And actually, one of the things that struck me there is that they didn't only, you know, allow people to upload their lessons, but they combined that with reputational metrics. So the more other teachers would download your lessons, mm-hmm. criticize your lessons, improve your lessons, the more status you would obtain in the system. And at the end of the school year, your principal will not only ask you, you know, how well did you teach the students in your class, but also what contribution do you make to the education systems? How do you help other teachers? How do other people regard you in the system? And those kinds of systems of lateral accountability are often much more powerful than the kind of vertical accountability, top-down accountability that we have. So I don't necessarily see a contradiction in this. In fact, you know, China's or Japan's approach to what I call curated crowdsourcing of education practice is a great example for how we can identify and share good practice among practitioners. It's also, in a way, much more powerful than things like, you know, performance-related pay, the kind of systems that we often put in place, or bureaucratic accountability. It might even be fairer, because being judged by the whole profession might actually give you a more reliable assessment than just being judged by, you know, one person in the system and so on. And sometimes, you know, we can unlock the creativity of teachers simply by tapping into the desire of people to contribute, to collaborate, and also to be recognized for this. There's a lot of good ideas happening. If we would only know what are the good ideas in the system, we could actually do a lot more in improvement. But the most important reason why ownership, in my view, is so important is that the kind of traditional approach that we have, you know, someone designs a curriculum and then it trickles down through the system and until it arrives in the classroom, that was really good enough when it took, you know, decades to change workplaces and so on. Today, in the kind of rapid changes that we live through, that kind of long kind of process no longer works. We need to have much more agile, much more flexible education systems. And that requires a much higher degree of professionalism. And what I mean by this is, you know, high level of professional knowledge. Now, teachers need to be really good in their subjects. They need to really understand how students learn, and they need to know a lot about their students. Professional collaboration, the mechanisms that teachers have and the time they spend to work with their colleagues to frame good practice, the investment they make in designing innovative learning environments and working with other teachers. Finally, professional autonomy. Do teachers have the room and space actually to be designers of new environments? I
remember visiting a school one time to look at the technology, and the superintendent said to me, and these words are always in my memory, you came to look at technology, but remember that this is about the teaching, and we don't look at teachers as sages on the stage. We don't look at them even as facilitators or guides on the side. It's exactly what you said. We look at them as to be educational designers.
Yeah.
How does
you know, I mean, that's technology is an interesting part in this. You know, technology is unlikely to ever replace poor teaching. But what can technology do is to amplify great teaching, great experience. And this can elevate the role of teachers from simply, you know, disseminating, imparting knowledge to working as co-creators of knowledge with peers and with students, to be good coaches, to be mentors, to be facilitators, to be evaluators, to be designers of innovative learning environments. And I think that's really what technology can do. Today, intelligent digital learning systems cannot just teach you science. They can also study how you actually learn science. They are very, very good in sort of thinking through and finding out what problems you find difficult, where you're good at, where you get stuck, what your metacognitive approaches to learning is. We have so much more potential than in the kind of traditional classroom setting to personalize learning styles with much, much greater granularity. And or think about virtual laboratories. Today, as a student, you don't just need to hear about an experiment. You can do an experiment. You know, play with things and find out new things, inquiry-based learning, new pedagogies, all of that is possible with technology. But once again, you know, it will not diminish the demand for teachers. It will actually make teaching a much more demanding professional kind of knowledge. That's, you know, again, technology isn't going to replace teaching. It's going to amplify the best, very best teaching and elevate the role of teachers, making it a much more demanding job, as happens in other professions as well. Now, one teacher can now educate millions of people also. You know, you can learn from the teacher that matches your personal learning style, as opposed to just relying on the teacher who happens into your own classroom. So this is the potential, but again, you know, I think we will not get around in building the best kind of teaching force for that.
In order to build that teaching force, the collaboration, the peer interaction, much of what you've discussed, that takes time. And am I correct that it different countries vary on how much time they give teachers to do that? As I recall, I forget whether it's TALIS or other data, that the United States, a teacher is on his or her feet teaching, spending more hours than almost any other developed nation, meaning that that's not time that they have to be interacting with each other.
Yeah, you know, there are several factors that come together. You know, first of all, teacher pay is still relatively low. And then, indeed, the focus on relatively small classes has meant in the U.S. that teachers have to spend more time teaching than in other countries. That relative teaching load is very high, giving teachers a lot less time. To give you an example, if you're a teacher in China or Japan, you teach about half the number of hours that an American teacher will teach. But actually, Japanese and Chinese teachers work even more than American teachers. They can spend a lot more time working with individual students, working on, you know, design of new kind of lesson plans, lesson study. They can observe a classroom of another teacher every week and so on. There's a lot of space to actually advance and elevate the teaching profession. I think that's very, very important.
So
you know, technology can be very powerful in designing ecosystems for this. It can, you know, connect students, it can connect teachers, it can actually scale and spread good practice. I think there's a lot of potential here for us to use new technologies to build a kind of ecosystems for learning in the system. You know, you can't expect your students to become lifelong learners if they do not see their teachers to practice lifelong learning and advancing.
So you write about the United States, that you talk about untapped potential, and you write that the U.S. was an education superpower in the 1960s, but failed to move forward quickly enough as more and more countries surpassed the United States' average level of education. So in what areas has, in your view, the United States failed to move forward quickly enough?
Well, you know, I think there's no question that the U.S. helps some students to do really, really well. You know, that's true in school, that's true in university education. But other countries have moved faster to help all students learn at high levels, not to basically ensure that education is not just elevating a few, but really providing every student with access to excellent teaching. Second, the instructional system in the U.S. has become somewhat a kind of mile wide, but just an inch deep. You know, lots of things are being taught at relatively shallow depths. The curricula, the instructional systems are negotiated with lots of players. Some of them don't have students, actually, or student learning needs at the heart of their interests. So that's a big challenge for teachers, not teaching lots of stuff. When you look to the highest performing education systems, you see more rigor. That is basically a higher emphasis on cognitive demand, cognitive activation of students. You see a lot more focus, fewer things being taught in much greater depth. Go to a Japanese or Finnish classroom, they would deal with one concept in an hour, not in 20 or 30 exercises to be done by students. They focus really on, can you think like a mathematician as opposed to teaching you lots of formulas and equation? Can you think like a scientist as opposed to just making sure you know lots of things in biology and chemistry? You know? So I think those emphasis incoherence in the learning system. You'd see learning systems which are designed around, you know, how student learning progresses, actually. There's a lot of, you know, learning neuroscience built into the design of instructional systems, which we don't find in the U.S., where sort of it's more patched together and also often built in very local levels. Third, you know, the U.S. is still a very industrial approach to education. again, all students taught in similar ways, kind of teachers more seen as the one who implements practice rather than to design and contribute to the profession. And when teacher quality is low, you know, governments are more tempted to tell teachers exactly what to teach and how they want to get this done. And other countries have moved faster to make teaching a high-level knowledge profession, where teachers have greater ownership over, you know, the content of their teaching, and a more collaborative teacher culture, so that they, you know, teacher autonomy doesn't mean, you know, I do what I like, but I do what I know is right in the name of my profession. So that level of profession with a practice is greater in countries. I think those are three areas. And then last but not least, you can look at spending patterns. You know, most high-performing countries are better than the U.S. in aligning resources with needs, making sure that the students with the greatest needs get the best educational opportunities. So I think together, I think those are the areas where the United States has fallen behind over the years. And the industrial approach to education actually was very effective for its own time. But today, where education really needs to help all students to succeed, we need to think about new ways of teaching, new ways of learning, and that requires a renewed emphasis on education.
I note that sometimes yesterday's reform is today's impediment.
Absolutely. You know, and one of the thing is, if the hardest thing in education is not, you know, what to do, it's actually about how to get things done. The knowledge about what works in education is only as good as our capacity to really act on that knowledge. And to transform schooling at scale, we don't just need a good vision of what is needed, but also really good policies to make change happen. And the road of educational reform is littered with good ideas that were poorly implemented. And actually to take the time to see reforms through is the key, and actually the laws, regulations, the institutions, they are just a tiny tip of a very large iceberg. No? And that's where we focus. You know, we focus on the small sector, but actually under the trouble is that, you know, why it's so hard to move education systems forward is that there is a much larger invisible part of the education system that is under the waterline. And that's where the kind of collisions occur.
And so can you give some examples?
Yeah, this is about, you know, the motivations, the fears, the attitudes of people. You know, if you do not engage teachers in the design of change and reform and the design of the instructional system, they'll always be suspicious, and they rarely help you with implementation. So being really transparent about objectives, making sure that reforms are designed with very strong bottom-up support, professional support by the teaching profession is very, very important. And it's also, you know, policy can do a lot to inspire innovation, inspire ideas. Now, it's again something we can learn from countries, you know, as far away as China. If you want to explore something in this system, the government will actually give you as a teacher or as a school a grant to do an experiment. And if you're successful at the end of the year, they will not say it's good or bad. They will say, well, actually looks interesting. Show us you can replicate this in 10 other schools with 10 other teachers and 10 other places. And if you're successful, well, you become an experimental school. So relying on the innovative practice. And accountability is about, you know, spurring innovation, creativity in the system, not about compliance and conformity. So I think those devices are very, very important, dealing with the asymmetries between winners and losers in the reform processes. Now, that's always the most difficult part. Making sure that people understand what the goals of reform are, why we are going through this, parents included. And reform takes time, and you need to bring people on board. And those systems that have actually successfully addressed the political economy of reform, that's why I devote much of the book to, because that's the hardest part in change. It's not about finding out what the right ideas are. Research and analysis has really helped us to understand that really well. It's about making change happen.
So as you're talking, I'm struck because I think I believe there's a spectrum that I call from tradition to transformational, and systems and people come enter at different points on that spectrum. We want to be moving to the transformational, but we also have to understand the traditional and what works. It's the teacher quality is still uppermost. That's a very traditional value. What that teacher does is something else, and what we're asking that teacher to do. But it's, I, to me, the biggest challenge in the United States, at least, is to be able to move from on that spectrum and to get large numbers to move, as opposed to just the 10 to 15% that are always out front.
Yeah, but you know, don't underestimate the number of people in the system with great ideas, you know, that currently don't have great careers. You know, how can you actually mobilize the best ideas in the education systems? How you can give those teachers and school leaders the kind of role that allows them to actually ensure that others are kind of participating in this? How you can create incentives for schools to share best practice and collaborate and so on. So I think actually public policy can do a lot to mobilize the many good ideas that are already in the system.
So we've been talking about challenges. What changes are you seeing in emerging trends in the delivery of education or the way populations are learning? Are we moving in the right direction as a world?
I think in many parts of the world we see very interesting things. I think the big shift that we have, you know, from imparting content knowledge to what we call competency-based learning, the greater focus on social emotional outcomes, character qualities. That's the kind of things that actually computers are not as good as these days. And how we can sort of pair the artificial intelligence with the kind of human qualities. A lot of thought is going into this. Curricula and instructional systems are advancing. I think also many countries have made good progress in professionalizing the teaching force, understanding that we need a very different caliber of teachers to deliver on a 21st century kind of learning system. I think those are areas where I'm encouraged that education systems are advancing. On technology, you know, I talked about the potential of technology. We don't see that much happening. Education is sort of lagging behind and capitalizing on the potential transformative powers of, you know, technological innovation. But I think those are areas where maybe the next years will show us progress. But my assessment overall is that, on balance, the world is moving faster than our school systems. Now, the gap between what societies really need these days, despite the progress that we see in education, and what schools provide is becoming larger, not smaller.
So some quick questions that have been sent in from viewers. Margie in Illinois asks, what do you see as the role of project-based learning in building world-class education systems?
You know, innovative learning environments play an important role. Finland would be a country that has moved almost entirely to project-based or theme-based learning. The benefits of that is that it brings together not just students on projects, it creates sort of a greater sense of ownership over learning, more control, more self-regulated learning. It often also brings teachers together. You know, suddenly, you know, the science teacher works together with a history teacher on framing problems, working on problems. That's the opportunity. At the same time, we need to understand that the opportunity cost of project-based learning are high as well. So they are good learning environments to foster, you know, higher order thinking, collaboration, and so on. They are not ideal learning environments for, you know, very simple kind of tasks. It's really they are an important part of the mix of good instructional philosophies, and that's how we see them in the highest performing countries. But it's not that all learning should necessarily be project-based. It's really teachers understanding the different learning needs and opportunities and embracing a variety of pedagogic strategies. Those are the teachers that are most successful.
And from Washington, D.C., Alice asks, what are the most important things state legislatures can do to build world-class education systems?
Well, you know, I think public policy is really the key to advancing an education. Public policy decides, you know, how do we align resources with needs? You know, how do we make the necessary investments in education, providing the regulatory frameworks that actually, you know, ensure that there is peer learning among schools, that the education systems advance. They are the ones that actually design at least the frameworks for what students learn, the curricula design, important role in this. They can, you know, spur innovation, build research capacity in the system, the kind of knowledge that education systems need to advance. You can really see no education system in the world that has come to be a leading system that doesn't have a very, very strong systems of public policy.
So I guess the final question I have is, if it is so clear about what the need, you mentioned the world getting ahead of the education systems, it's so clear about what the needs are, whether it's workforce needs, need to students to learn how to learn, the economic needs to have a quality workforce. If these needs are so apparent, which I believe they are, then why aren't what do we need to do to make sure our education systems keep up with these?
You know, what is really hard in life and in society is to balance the future with the present. You know, education is an investment in the future, is an investment in the long term. And there are a lot of distractors that keep us, you know, focusing on the present. And I think that's the first where really good education starts with, you know, ensuring that, you know, all children have the opportunities to develop their potential, to ensure that, you know, we prioritize this when we think about how we allocate social spending in education, how we mobilize talent. In a way, you know, if you think about capitalism, the source, you know, the key to success in our economies is that everybody is on a level playing field. You know, otherwise our societies become very quickly fragmented and unequal and so on. And I think that is about ensuring educational opportunity. And it's sort of easy to say, really hard to do, but that's where you can see the big dividing line between those education systems advanced. Sometimes, you know, countries like Vietnam, they're actually poor. They would have lots of reasons not to prioritize education. They have put education first. Korea in the 1960s now. Used to be had to have the, at that time, had the level of economic development as Afghanistan today, one of the least kind of developed education systems. That's when they put education first. They wanted to ensure that, you know, every person has, you know, the chance to actually live a successful life. And today they're one of the star economies around the world. So in that's, I think, where everything starts.
So PISA will be administered this fall. What can you tell us about the iteration of this assessment, and will it be, how will it be, if it will be different from the 2015 administration?
Yeah, you know, every PISA assessment adds a novel component. In 2012, we focused, you know, problem-solving skills, creative problem-solving skills. In 2015, we added social skills, you know, collaborative problem-solving. In 2018, we're going to look at global competency, the capacity of students to see the world through different lenses, perspectives, appreciate different ways of thinking, different ways of working, different cultures. So that's a new element. But we're also reframing our assessment of reading skills. You know, we have tested reading skills many times before, but today we live in a digital age. In a kind of print age, literacy was about extracting information from texts that were pre-quoted. You read them from beginning to end. Today in the digital age, is much more about validating information, triangulating different sources. You know, in the past, when you didn't know the answer to a question, you could look it up in an encyclopedia, and you could trust the answer to be true. Today, you look something up on Google, you find 50,000 answers to your question, and nobody tells you what's right, what's wrong, what's true, what's not true. The construct of literacy is about constructing knowledge, not about extracting knowledge. So we've really revamped our reading assessment for 2018 to reflect that difference.
Andreas, this discussion obviously reflects a lot of the challenge, the interesting, the incredible, stimulating, I should say, material in your book, World Class, How to Build a 21st Century School System. As we wrap up, any summary or thoughts that you'd like to leave us with?
Well, you know, I think while I wrote this book and looked through all the examples of, you know, successful change that we have seen in so many parts of the world, in poor and wealthy countries, among disadvantaged students, among privileged students, I've become really optimistic that this is a manageable agenda. You know, the challenge is not to make the impossible possible, but to make the possible attainable. And we have lots of really good examples. What we can do is learn from those examples. This is not about copying and pasting experiences from others. You know, that's not what this book is about. It's about looking seriously and dispassionately at good practice in our own countries, but also around the world, and then figuring out, you know, how can we borrow and learn from those experiences to help, you know, every student attain an excellent education.
So that's all the time we have today for this discussion, which has proven to be, as always, with Andreas Schleicher, lively and rich. I want to thank Andreas Schleicher very much for his work on this new book and for being with us in Washington today to discuss it. Now, I do want you to keep in mind that today's event will be archived on www.allfored.org/webinars, and be sure to visit tinyurl.com/worldclassbook, where you can get a free, I'm stressing that again, free online copy of Andreas Schleicher's new book, World Class, How to Build a 21st Century School System. I'm Bob Wise for the Alliance for Excellent Education. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.